This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Malcolm Keating on a brand new 2020 publication, Controversial Reasoning in Indian Philosophy. Hello, Malcolm, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Raj. Thanks for having me.
Malcolm, where are you these days? Are you still Assistant Professor of Philosophy and Humanities Division at Yale and US College, Singapore?
I am indeed. I am in the United States right now, teaching online for them, given some complexities of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, but I am indeed still in Singapore in some sense.
So you're teaching in Singapore, but you're located in the United States.
Yes, at least at this point for the semester, for some family reasons and things. I was on research leave in the U.S. When the pandemic hit, so that made things a little bit complicated. But I am still teaching Indian philosophy of language and some other courses at Yale and U.S. with my students online by Zoom in the mornings and evenings.
You know, I'm in a similar boat in that I'm situated in the land of Toronto, and I teach at the OCHS, the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies, online. And those students themselves are all over the place, mm-hmm. many of whom are in the UK, but some in America, some in Australia, mm-hmm. Some in various European and Asian countries. And I've recently accepted a position to teach undergrads at the University of Calgary while in Toronto to teach them online. Mm-hmm. When I initially started teaching online in 2017, I went from a cynic to a convert to mm-hmm. my proselytize, you know. You can do a fair bit. It's quite shocking how mm-hmm. intimate an experience you can have from abroad. And these interviews, I've been doing them on Zoom for as long as I've been doing the channel.
Yeah.
Zencastr when I can. Mm-hmm. That's the preferred mode, but you know a thing or two about these interviews, don't you?
Yeah. I have been doing some interviews on the language channel for the New Books Network for the past few months, I think starting in February or thereabouts.
Imagine you're enjoying it.
Yeah. It's a fun time. I get to talk to cool people doing interesting stuff in language, broadly speaking, typically philosophical works, because that's my area, but not always. Sometimes branch out to other kinds of disciplines. So yeah, it's been fun. I've learned a lot.
Yeah, similar with the Hindu Studies podcast. I mean, there's so much in Hindu Studies that I would never read, because it doesn't really pertain to my work, and you know, it forces me to read everything from Hinduism and ecology to you name it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's good. It's actually good. Yeah. My job, probably similar to yours and your channel, is to keep things as accessible as possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of stay on the surface and kind of go scuba diving every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And then my job is to bring us back up for air, so that the audience can stay with us. So controversial reasoning in Indian philosophy, the subtitle is Major Texts and Arguments in Arthopathy.
Yes.
Switch it up a little bit. Tell me who might be interested in this book.
Well, the hope is that we're getting a few different groups of people. So there are people who do philosophy, and that includes what we might call Indian philosophy, but it also includes people who are working in the broadly analytic tradition. So going back to kind of Frege and Russell, depending on your, you know, understanding the history there. So I'm thinking people that are curious about how knowledge works, how we acquire knowledge, how we communicate using incomplete sentences, so knowledge, language, and also logic, people who are interested in the structure of arguments and the structure of reasoning. That's kind of the big picture for folks in philosophy. But then also, I think there are people who are interested in Indian philosophy and who may already have some acquaintance with some of the thinkers in this text. And these can be people who are in philosophy departments, but also often in South Asian studies or religious studies departments, who are interested in the sort of these Sanskrit thinkers already. So those are the sort of the two main groups within philosophy. But then I also think, you know, of people who are primarily maybe Sanskritists or who are not interested in philosophy per se, but are interested in the broader intellectual world that these thinkers are part of. It's also a book for those people as well. So again, Asian studies, religious studies, sorts of areas, Hindu studies, because you know, if you're interested in Hinduism, part of Hinduism writ large is reasoning about texts and reasoning about how we come to know things. So,
great, thank you. So, the book I think provides a great deal of fodder for folks who study Indian philosophy or Indian philosophical debates, and it seems to me a fairly accessible sort of entry into the very nature of the debates, right? Like it's sort of a, you know, you can go and attend a specialist conference presentation, but it's a good sort of entry conference. It's sort of like medicine, you know, it's a user-friendly conference. You can get a handle of what the, the lay of the land is type thing, which is great, which is not always easy. Well, it's rarely easy to accomplish.
Yeah, it's hard.
So congrats on that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about the genesis of the volume?
Yeah, so the idea for this book started when I was back in graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin. Very briefly, I came across the topic of this book, arthopathy, which is sometimes translated as postulation, presumption. We'll talk about that later. In the work of another thinker, who my dissertation was on and who my recent book was on, Mukulabutta. And so I was like, oh, okay, this guy's talking about this thing, arthopathy. It seemed kind of minor in his work, and it turned out not to be. So I was like, oh, this is interesting. And so I started to explore the intellectual context that he was working in, why he thought this was important, this kind of way of reasoning, this way of knowing, arthopathy. Started exploring that a little bit, and I went to a conference in Greece where I did a panel on epistemology with Elisa Freski, who does Mimamsa, which is an area where arthopathy, as we'll see, is important. And we just started talking about arthopathy and kind of lamenting the state of the discipline in the sense that, you know, if we want to talk to people in philosophy about these ideas, it's hard for people to have an entryway into it. And also that there's a lot of work that hasn't yet been done on this topic, just from the point of view of Indian philosophy. And so, you know, kind of talked about this over the years, and I thought, well, we should just put together some texts, you know, graduate student at this point, you know, like, and I was like, this would be fun, you know, why don't we just kind of put together an edited volume? And so, you know, like maybe 5 years later, it's come out, because what then I needed to do was find the right folks to contribute who could write scholarly yet accessible translations. And we thought, well, you know, in conversation with these folks who are doing the translation, I thought, well, why not also have some essays? Because the translation is going to be interesting to people maybe already interested in the topic, but the essays can help people dig into the ideas there. So if you're a philosopher and you're not sure why this is important, you can start with the essays and see the connections and then go back to the primary sources. So it kind of came to be a larger, more complicated project than a typical just collection of texts. But that's kind of the story, the genesis of the text. So the person I mentioned, Elisa Fresky, is involved, but also other people who I pulled in as time went on to translate and to write papers.
Well, it's interesting that whenever we as academics lament a niche in scholarship, we can always become the change, so to speak.
right, exactly.
And fill that niche. However, it's much easier just to complain about it.
That is true. It is true.
So one of the interesting things about the texture of the volume is that it includes a primary text as well as a primary text that hasn't really been translated into English before, as well as, of course, essays. And there is a website, a companion website, where you can find the transliteration of the selected works in the volume. We will link that in the description of the podcast. So there's two directions I wish to take. For those of you who listen to me regularly, I don't have a map when I come into these conversations. I sort of like to speak in the moment with the general thrust of what we hope you might want to hear about the book. But I think I want to first start with this. You know, okay, the title is Controversial Reasoning in Indian Philosophy. I want to talk about this thing called Indian philosophy, just broadly. We'll have plenty of time to delve into, you know, the big elephant in the room, which is what is Arthapathy and all that. Right. But like, what is Indian philosophy? And maybe I don't want you to necessarily confine your response or respond solely to, you know, this kind of crude comparison of Indian philosophy versus Western philosophy. But that may be something worth considering as well as you school me today.
Well, I mean, I think the thing to say about Indian philosophy is that when I think of Indian philosophy, let me put it this way, I am attending to a set of sort of traditions within the Indian subcontinent, of course, not necessarily overlapping with the national boundaries of India today, a tradition of sort of critical investigation into things like how we come to have knowledge, into how we interpret texts, into the nature, fundamental nature of the world, things like this. These are and these are found within different disciplines or shastras that may not be what a lot of people think of as philosophical in this sense. So there's the tradition of the darshanas, which a lot of people know about, these different, they're often characterized as schools, Nyaya, Mimamsa, Vedanta, and so on, in the orthodox, in quotes here, Brahminical kind of tradition, as well as people like Buddhists and Jains and so on. And you think of, well, these are folks who are kind of debating back and forth about the nature of the self and reality and so on. And that seems straightforwardly philosophical to, at least for many people who are doing what you might characterize as Western philosophy, some familiar questions and topics. But I also think of Indian philosophy as being in, there being philosophical thought in what we might call the grammatical traditions of thinkers, the Vyakarna, thinking about, for instance, Panini and Bhartrahari. They're considering how it is that words have reference, thinking about the relationship between syntax and semantics, things like that. And then there's also within what's often called poetics, the Alankara Shastra. So this is the discipline of poetics and figuration. You know, this is pragmatics. This is thinking about how we do things with words, how people respond cognitively and emotionally to poetry and drama. And that has a lot of overlap with what we would characterize as philosophy. And so I would say that Indian philosophy is big, it's vast. And the boundaries may not look the same as what you find in a philosophy department in, say, the United States or Europe or Asia. But I think that there's a sort of family resemblance and overlap. And I think the differences are interesting to attend to as well. So,
thank you. Now, the following question that comes to mind is something where you could probably write 10 books on. But maybe if we can permit you, absolve you of all necessary academic slicing and dicing and grant you the range of motion of an armchair thinker.
Okay.
Philosophy versus religion, the distinction is very different in the Western tradition, obviously. And in India, what would you say about that? Is philosophy very different from, interspersed with? Like, how would you describe the relationship between Hindu religion and Indian philosophy, for example?
Well, I mean, I think that as you and your listeners, I'm sure, know, I mean, the concept of religion it has a very particular pedigree in Europe and sort of what we characterize as the West in particular. And so, I mean, I would say that distinction, though, even breaks down in so-called Western philosophy before a certain period. I think that those kinds of categories from sort of modern sort of post-Enlightenment thought are not necessarily super helpful in understanding what's going on in the texts that I'm looking at most of the time, just in terms of their historical period of composition. So I think there are concerns in these texts that are about how human beings live their lives with regard to things of ultimate concern. And I think that's the purview of philosophy and of religion. Now, are there different methodologies? Well, yeah, maybe in different time periods. But so, for instance, the thinkers that I am interested in, the Mimamsakas, school of Vedic hermeneutics and exegesis, they're tough for philosophers because there's a concern with Vedic ritual, and they have some starting points which are going to be different from, you know, maybe modern philosophers in the academy. But when you dig in and look at what their concerns are, they're also concerned with things like how action works, how commands are structured. They're concerned with syntax, semantics, epistemology, and all that's bound up with these concerns in a very historically concrete religious context, but also in a broader sense of, like, how do we as human beings comport ourselves and act ethically? I mean, I'm not sure if this is answering your question. I would just say that I don't like trying to silo off these categories, and I try and understand what these thinkers are doing in their texts and how they're thinking of themselves and what categories they're drawing. Those boundaries may not overlap with the modern ones as well.
No, it's always a scenic route in these interviews, and I tend to try and avoid leading questions. And I sort of like when folks can break through the binaries innate to, more often than not, Western modes of thinking and understanding the world, like the Hindu goddesses of the breast or of the tooth. In the Devi Mahatmya, she's actually both, and you'd be surprised at the one which is prioritized, type thing. So no, your answer is fine. I'll tell you part of the reason, if I may, part of the reason why I asked the question is, I have an interesting relationship to what you may call Indian philosophy, in that I've received years of training and teaching from an Indian teacher. Outside of my academic work, which is on Hindu narrative, Sanskrit narrative. But when I discovered, I initially went to the University of Toronto to study philosophy in English, you know, artsy-fartsy type, right? In history, did half a degree, and then I dropped out and worked for a while. And then I came back because I discovered a course today. It started Introduction to Hinduism. didn't know they taught quote unquote Hinduism at the University of Toronto. And under the rubric of Hinduism, I was able to feed my curiosity about philosophy. I think my first paper was on Shankara, Vedanta. Mm-hmm. And so Indian philosophy has played a fair bit in my personal path. It hasn't played a fair bit at all in my academic trajectory because I'm more interested in narrative. Mm-hmm. But I find myself now teaching, TAing, tutoring, an online course at the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies in Hindu philosophy, where we look at Vedanta and Sankhya. And, you know, there are various types of students who come to that course. Yeah. And invariably the snag is this philosophy of religion or theology. And it's sort of like, I'm glad you answered the question the way you did, which was to problemize the very question. The question is an imposition. And we as slicers and dicers of of these texts, we're afforded that purview. But for people coming into an intro course, whether they're continuing studies learners or undergrads, that seems to be a common snag to kind of think around. So thank you for answering it the way you did. So Indian philosophy, specifically, you were looking, Arthapati is a kind of epistemology. Now, before we dive into Arthapati, could you tell us a little bit about epistemology in the Indic context?
Yeah. So epistemology is the study of knowledge or knowing in philosophy. And there is a corresponding sort of category within what I'm going to call, for the purposes of this interview, Indian philosophy. And that's the pramana vadins. So pramana is a term that means a epistemic instrument, a way of knowing. Sometimes people call it a knowledge source. And so there's a group of people who are concerned with these ways of knowing, how it is we come to know, like things like perception when you see something, or testimony when you hear somebody's telling you something that's true. These are ways of knowing, or epistemic instruments is my preferred term. So there's a group of people who are concerned with how these epistemic instruments work, how many there are, how we can check if we're using them, applying them properly. And this kind of cuts across Buddhists and Nyaya and Mimamsa. And so you can say there's a discipline of epistemology in some sense going on here. And so the thing I would just note for people who are familiar with epistemology in contemporary analytic philosophy is that there is a real concern in this context with current episodes of knowing. So we're concerned with how it is that an individual person at a particular moments in time comes to have knowledge and sort of a moment of awareness that something is the case. So seeing that there's a computer in front of me, or knowing that Raj is telling me he's in Toronto and that that's true. And so that is a concern that they have, which in some ways puts them in a different starting point than just thinking about knowledge sort of writ general, which includes things like I have dispositions or like inclined to report beliefs that are true to you. We're concerned with moments here, sort of actions, events, I should say.
And what are sort of the typical pramanas? You could even mention means of knowledge. You could even mention how they may differ among the two schools you're talking about. Tell us about the means of knowledge.
Yeah. So first of all, in this context, we're really considering Nyaya and Mimamsa. So Nyaya is a group of thinkers known as some people call them the sort of logicians, but reasoners is maybe better. They're concerned with rules of reasoning, with rules of I'll just leave it at that. And then Mimamsa, as I mentioned earlier, is a group concerned in particular with Vedic interpretation. So they're very concerned with language. Both of these groups of thinkers that are concerned with epistemology, broadly speaking. So for both of these groups, perception is a pramana or a way of knowing. In other words, if I'm actually seeing something, then I know that the thing is there. So perception, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting, all of our sort of sense faculties. Those are pramanas, ways of knowing. That's a common one, starting point for most folks. And then you have inference, which is an important one in this context. So inference is when I have had, so here's the standard example, smoke and fire. I've had a bunch of experiences in the past where I've seen smoke and fire together. And then comes this day where I'm out walking and I see smoke in the distant hills. And I say, oh, there's fire on that hill. I have done what's called inference or anumana, because I have reasoned from the seeing of that smoke on the hill, against the fact that I know that where there's smoke, there's fire, because I've experienced these connections, to the fact that case on the hill is like the ones I've experienced. And so there's fire on the hill. So that's inference. And, that is an important one for orthopathy. And then the other sort of big one to mention in this context is testimony. Testimony is when someone tells me something that is true and that they themselves have knowledge of. And so when I hear and understand what they're telling me, I also come to have knowledge. So those are three of the ones that really overlap. The key one for this book, which we'll talk about, is inference. Because that one, one group of thinkers, Nyaya philosophers, say, well, this is there's a various different kinds of inference. Smoke and fire is one, but there's others. Mimamsa philosophers, though, say, no, there's actually another one that you haven't included, and that's orthopathy. And that's a case where, say, I go out, I know that my friend Raj is alive, he's healthy, he's well, and I know he's at home. He's always at home. I always see him sitting on his front porch, right? So it's something I know about. He just like sits out there all the time. I go out. Yeah, exactly. Sitting out drinking beer on his porch. So I go out one day and I see that Raj is not there. Now, I'm going to set aside for just a moment how I whether I see his absence directly or I infer that he's not there, but Raj isn't there. Through orthopathy, through postulation, I reason this way. Well, it would be inexplicable or it would be impossible that Raj is alive and that he is absent from his house, unless he is alive and he's away from his house, he's outside. So this is postulation. I have said there's something that doesn't make sense unless there's this further fact that is true, and that's it, that Raj is alive and outside of his home. Now, Nyaya philosophers are going to say, well, this is just inference. And we can give you a story of how this fits into our model of inference. It's not exactly like the smoke fire case. It turns out to be a little different, but it's inference. And Mimamsa philosophers say, well, no, this is something different. So that's the high level overview. We can elaborate as we go.
That was very well elucidated. So just for those of you out there listening for the quiz when we're done, kidding, obviously, Indian philosophy, epistemology, means of knowing, three primary means that we're talking about are pratyaksha, direct perception, sensory perception, anumana, inference, where there's smoke, there's fire, and shabda, so spake the Lord. Yeah. Right. It was on good testimony. You know, an expert tells you, your physician tells you something about the human mm-hmm. body. He's on a crackpot, you assume mm-hmm. that's correct. And so those are three primary means of knowing. Mm-hmm. And now this middle one, this inference, where there's smoke, there's fire, that's great. But where Raj is not home, Raj is God knows where. Mm-hmm. Can I just infer something? Mm-hmm. Or do I have to postulate, posit? Do right. I have to generate something right. from within me in order to arrive at a reasonable conclusion?
That's right. I think there's two things I would say. One is I want to sharpen the idea of, so I use the word testimony, and I would say that, there's not a really great neutral term for Shabda. I mean, Shabda is just like speech or language, maybe is better for Mimamsa, because for Mimamsa philosophers, the Vedas aren't authored by a divine being. They're just always existent. And so we don't, in the case for them, always, for every case of language, have a speaker who is a trustworthy conveyor of truth. So that's an important wrinkle here, that we don't have to, for Mimamsa, always have a trustworthy speaker for something to count as language knowing, and knowing from that way. So that's one little thing I would want to make sure we make clear, because that's important for Mimamsa here. The other thing that what you were saying about way you were characterizing the Raj not being at home case and the smoke and fire case, maybe one thing you can see that's a difference between them immediately is that I can have lots of experiences of smoke and fire being present together. But the problem with the case of your absence from home is that it's hard to draw a correlation or correspondence between the absence of something, the absence of one thing, and the existence of something else. So this is a thing that's known as negative only inference. And so it's something like wherever there's the absence of something, then there's some other property. But the worry is that without any kind of positive example, you're sort of unleashing any kind of inference. You can sort of just say, whenever there's the absence of this thing, let me put it this way. I'm trying to think what a good example is. So, an example that is used is living bodies. Living bodies have selves, right? That's a standard thing that people are asserting. But you could also put it this way: living bodies have this property; they don't not have a self. They don't lack a self. And why is that? Well, because living creatures are alive. And wherever there is someone's being alive, there's this corresponding property of not lacking a self. And then you give this negative example where you're like, well, here's a pot. A pot is not alive, and it lacks a self. But here's the thing: I can't give you a sort of a positive example of someone who is alive and does not lack a self, because all of the cases of people who are alive and don't lack a self are the cases under discussion. So I would be basically begging the question in order to give that example. The only examples I have are negative examples, cases where it's not like the thing under discussion. But the worry here is, it's like, well, how can I infer just from things which are different the presence of something, the property that I'm trying to argue for? It's like, it doesn't seem like it's related. It's like, sure, pots don't have selves. That's fine. We see that wherever there's these pots, there isn't this thing, their selfhood. And there is the presence of this thing not having selfhood. But how in the world does that have anything to do with whether or not you and I lack selves? So the worry here for this kind of inference known as negative only inference is that how do we move from only negative examples to the thing that we're inferring? And so in the case of Raj not being at home, it's like, well, I don't have a positive example of someone's absence from the house and being somewhere else, because I can't perceive both of those things at the same time.
Right. And so I mentioned that you will be schooling me today, and hopefully in so doing schooling whomever is listening. So we go to Michael's house. We ring Michael's doorbell. Mm-hmm. And ding dong, no one answers. Mm-hmm. Well, we have a key to Michael's house. We enter Michael's house.
Yeah, we see.
Michael's not asleep. Michael's nowhere on the premises. Mm-hmm. Michael's not in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Where is Michael? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like, where's Waldo? But Michael's not really there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Where is Michael?
Exactly.
And so, if one watches a great many Dateline episodes, one may mm-hmm. think the worst. Mm-hmm. Michael has been abducted. Michael mm-hmm. is in danger. Michael's injured. Michael mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. dead. Michael's in the trunk of someone's car. Michael's yep. at the movies.
Yeah.
Yep. Michael is God knows where. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, in all of these possibilities, mm-hmm. unlike the smoke and fire example, it's mm-hmm. not that your mind can land on one. It's sort of you postulate one of a number of things, mm-hmm. but it's not a singular thing that you can postulate.
Correct? Not exactly. So here's the important thing is that. Remember, I know that Michael is alive. Okay. So when I have this background piece of knowledge, Michael's alive. And when I come to the house and I see that he is absent, I still have this information that he's alive. But here's a place where he's not alive. He's not alive at his house. So it doesn't make sense that he is alive and not alive at his house unless I say, well, he's alive somewhere else. So the important thing for, at least for Mimamsa, is that I am trying to account for an apparent clash or an apparent, at least this is the Bhatta view here, which I'm we can talk about another one in a second. There's an apparent inconsistency between two things. And in order to account for that apparent inconsistency, there's this third thing that I have to posit. And the key thing here for Mimamsa is that it has to be this third thing. So, and this is one of the disputes that comes out in this book, where there's a kind of reasoning that a lot of people might initially think this sounds like, which is an inference to the best explanation. So a lot of people might say, well, okay, well, what I'm doing is I'm saying, well, the best explanation of why Michael's not at home is that he's outside, right? And he's alive. Well, I'd say that's... The thing is that with an inference to the best explanation, it's one explanation among many. And typically the status of the conclusion to an inference to the best explanation, we think of as like it's a hypothesis for further exploration. We don't so much characterize it as now this is something that I know. So the debate that comes up in this book is, well, it seems like what these Mimamsa philosophers are saying is, no, I know that this guy's not at home. I know that he's outside and that he's alive, and I'm not picking one option among many. It's sort of an inference to the only possible explanation. And so it's crucial that we recognize that this is a way of knowing, just like perception or testimony or inference. It gives us something that we know, and it gives us a specific thing that we know, which has to be the case given two other things that we know.
So for the school of Mimamsa, what's at stake? Why is this important?
Yeah. So for Mimamsa, there's a, there's a couple of things. First, big picture here. Why is this at all important? Well, when you come to know something, if someone, for instance, challenges you on your knowing, why do you know that? Well, there are a number of things you can do, but one thing you can do is you can point to the operation of your sense faculties. You can point to the way that you've reasoned and so on. And if you know that you're reasoning by arthopathy as opposed to by anumana, you're going to point to different features of your reasoning too. So that's a general thing that I think is probably at stake for everybody. For Mimamsa, though, they're really concerned, like I've said, with Vedic exegesis or an interpretation. And there's another way in which arthopathy works, which is having to do with texts, bits of text. So I just said that arthopathy works for Mimamsa, for Bhatta Mimamsas, as a sort of making sense out of something that otherwise wouldn't make sense. Two things. Well, this works in the context of texts as well. So, for instance, here's an example. I'll use the standard Sanskrit example, and then we can update it to a more fun modern one if you want. But here's a sentence somebody says: "Fat Devadatta does not eat during the day." Okay. Now, I start with this one because this is the one that's in the text. It doesn't necessarily have the same effect on most modern people. But here's the thing in the background: people. Devadatta, he's portly, he's stout, he's clearly not eating. You know, he's not abstaining from eating at all. But what I've just said is that he is not eating during the day. So what Mimamsa philosophers such as Kumarla will say is, well, there is a kind of arthopathy that works on language, shabda, as you said, things that we hear. And with that arthopathy, what doesn't make sense is that Devadatta is fat and that he doesn't eat during the day. That doesn't make sense unless Devadatta eats at night. And so that is the thing which is postulated or posited using arthopathy. Now, that's not a Vedic sentence, but it illustrates the way in which from things which are spoken, we can draw conclusions about things which are unspoken. So, and this is important when it comes to Vedic exegesis, because there are unspoken implications, let's say, of the Vedic texts, which Mimamsa philosophers are concerned to draw out. And they're concerned to show that this isn't just, it's not just one hypothesis among many, but this is something that we can know. This is a pramana, it's a way of knowing. So done correctly, and arthopathy lets us come to know something unspoken, unheard from a piece of text that we have heard.
So one example that's talked about in the book, and we mentioned it briefly in an earlier conversation, was, you know, someone saying door, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. while yep. they're carrying something.
Exactly.
Maybe their hands are full behind you, mm-hmm. coming into your building or coming in wherever. They say door. And then, so what the school of thought, if I'm understanding this correctly, is saying is that, well, you, the person has an intention. And if you successfully use arthopathy, you will know their intention.
Yeah. So
if unspoken, yes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and here I think I can make a little bit more precise something that I've been leaving hanging a bit. So I've mentioned Mimamsa, and there are two different groups within Mimamsa, Bhatta and Prabhakara. They're following, the first is following this commentator Kumarala Bhatta, who writes a commentary on the Shabara Bhasha. And then the second group is following a fellow named Prabhakara, long A shows that it's a follower's Prabhakaras, who also is writing commentaries on the same text. So it's sort of like two branches here. And when it comes to this case of Dor, these two groups of Mimamsa philosophers have slightly different accounts of what is going on. And this might help sharpen our understanding of Arthapathy and some of the disputes. So when you say Dor for someone like Kumarla, this is a kind, the way that I fill out or come to understand what's unspoken is called Shruta Arthapathy, or Arthapathy about what is heard, Shruta. And so for him, there's a sort of difference in kind between that kind of Arthapathy and the ones we've been talking about before, which are people who are not at home and things that I see. So all of the sort of epistemic instruments, the pramanas, except for language, they all work under this one kind of Arthapathy, Drishta Arthapathy. So Arthapathy about what was experienced. But the other kind of Arthapathy works with language. So one sort of rough way of getting at it is that the way that I'm my mind is working is that I am drawing conclusions. I'm trying to avoid using the word inference here because I don't want us to think this is anumana. I'm drawing conclusions. I'm reasoning with bits of language, and so that this is a different kind of reasoning in some sense than the reasoning that I'm doing with facts that I have observed. Let's say things that I've experienced through perception. And so what happens for Kumarla is when I hear someone say Dor, I am through this particular kind of Arthapathy, linguistic Arthapathy, I form in my mind, you might think, a complete sentence. So somewhere in my mind, I then entertain this linguistic bit, this sentence, open the door if I'm going in behind someone, I want them to keep the door open. Now, Prabhakara thinkers say, well, you don't actually need to entertain the whole sentence in the sense of filling in the linguistic bits. This whole distinction between two different kinds of Arthapathies, you know, like this is just splitting hairs, and it's actually not characterizing the way we reason, helpfully. Instead, what you're doing is you are just filling in the content or the fact or the object. So instead of completing the sentence in your mind, let's say, what you're doing is you're sort of moving to what the meaning of open would be. So I don't have to entertain the word open along with the word door. I just have to know what's meant. So this is a difference between the Bhatta and the Prabhakara on this, and it tracks. Folks who work in philosophy of language, contemporary philosophy of language, will know it is tracking a little bit some debates in contemporary linguistics and philosophy about how ellipsis works. But I'll just flag that, and I won't go into it.
Well, these distinctions must be quite relevant to Vedic exegesis or text versus language or something you can observe. Wouldn't that be the case?
Yeah, and so for the I could just mention in some of the texts in the that are translated in this book, there is discussion of what's known as uha, which is sort of a modification of Vedic mantras based on context. So you sort of, depending on the ritual action that you're doing, you're going to change the god that your mantra is being spoken to, and that might involve changing the sort of grammatical case, the case ending, because it's going to be a different morphology. So you decline the god's name differently, and so. How do we know how to do that? Well, we use Arthapathy is the answer. And so there's in one text that I translated, the Manomayodaya of Narayana Bhatta in the, 16th-ish century, there's a discussion about how arthopathy is important for Vedic mantras. There's very clear applications to specifically Vedic concerns in this discussion of arthopathy.
And so for the followers of Nyaya, what would they say about arthopathy?
Yeah, so I'd say two things. One is that broadly speaking, Nyaya philosophers are going to want to reduce arthopathy to anumana, this what often people characterize as or translate as inference. But again, recall that inference here is this particular kind of inference where I have observed or experienced this correlation between two things, and I know that where one thing is, the other thing also is. So Nyaya philosophers are going to say this is just anumana, but it's this particular kind of anumana that I mentioned earlier, which is a sort of negative only, where I am drawing my reasoning on the basis of sort of negative cases. I'm never seeing the person's absence from the house and their being somewhere else at the same time. I never observe that because I'm at the house. You just can't physically observe correlation between those two things. So you have to reason on the basis of something else, of sort of these negatives of examples. And so for Nyaya philosophers, they're broadly going to understand it in that way. But one of the points of this book is to say, you know, not all Nyaya philosophers have the same explanation of how arthopathy works. And in fact, one of the essays in this book argues that, we can get to this in a minute maybe, argues that in fact, not all Nyaya philosophers they're not all going to have the same position. So one of the interventions, I guess you could say, that this book is trying to do is to show that there's actually more to these debates than people have often understood. So a lot of times what you'll just see in textbooks is like, well, Mimamsa accept arthopathy, Nyaya reject it. For Nyaya, it's negative only inference. For Mimamsa, there's this debate between Bhatta and Prabhakar, and that's sort of it. But there hasn't been the attention paid to individual thinkers within these traditions and their particular perspectives. And so for Nyaya to really understand what Nyaya thinks, you have to say, well, which Nyaya philosopher? Are we talking early Nyaya philosophers like Vatsyayana and Ajotakara? Are we talking later philosophers like Gungesha? Are we talking, these are the questions that we're trying to answer in this book, to go back, to go beyond a sort of thinking of a school as like a monolith.
Are you currently still working on arthopathy?
Yes and no. I have a few drafts kind of sitting around that I think about now and again, in particular with regard to ellipsis and arthopathy. But really, arthopathy now it's coming up in the context of other texts where I feel like I have a better understanding of the broader context for the discussion about it. And I guess I would just say this, I see arthopathy as being very pervasive in Mimamsa in ways that I think we still need to appreciate. But it's not so much a particular focus for me right now. I'm actually looking at Upamana in Kumarala, which is the a pramana we didn't talk about, which is a comparison or analogy. So that's actually the pramana I'm looking at now. I'm trying to, some people joke that I'm just going through and finding the lesser discussed pramanas and trying to sort of understand.
You are a champion of the underdogs of means of knowledge.
Exactly. all the ones that Mimamsa thinks are independent pramanas and different from Nyaya, I want to go and go look at those. So.
Well, someone's got to do it. Why not? I guess so. I have a question. We're pretty much we're taking enough of your time for one day. Just one question that's a more broad question, not beyond the confines of the book. Mm-hmm. You seem to have an ability to translate philosophical concepts or discourse in an accessible way. Yes, that seems to be. Well,
thank you. I'm glad you think so.
That seems to be. Well, as somebody who straddles that line, it takes one to know one, I suppose. But I'm wondering, it comes across in the book, and you alluded that that was sort of one of the aims of the book. Mm-hmm. It also comes across in the interview where some people just seem to be more inclined or more able to render accessible complex ideas. Mm-hmm. There are those who feel the complexity is lost. Mm-hmm. There are those who feel that it's not, you know, it's the job of the interlocutor to keep up if they can. there are those who feel, well, none should be left behind if, mm-hmm. you know, so I'm just wondering, can you tell me a little bit about that in terms of, is that something that you typically, is it a way of being for you? Is it something you've consciously developed? Is it a teaching strategy? Is it a writing strategy? Yeah. If you don't mind sharing, I'd love to hear.
Sure. No, it's something I've been thinking about a lot more in the past few years, actually. So I do, let me put it this way. In what I've just been just talking to you about, I have been very aware that I have run sort of fast and loose over some distinctions. And there are really cool, interesting nuances that I omitted. But in the purpose of this context for this interview, my thought is, well, I'm hoping to get people to maybe find some interesting things in what I've said that they can dig into. And that I've hopefully not said anything that's so false that when they go and they read the actual details, they think I was misleading them. So that's sort of one principle, is audience sensitivity. And, you know, as academics, I think often our audiences are small. So for instance, this particular book, you know, you might think, well, there's about 10 people who know a lot about Arthopathy and Mimamsa and Nyaya and Buddhism, and, you know, and you can just make a very, very narrow group of people that we're just all sort of talking to one another. And I don't think that it's, I think there's a place and a time for that. I think the workshop that we did for this book was amazing in that way. We got into some super fine-grained details that, yeah, people should just, you know, people would have to really keep up. They would have to know a lot of things in order to keep up. But I think that for myself, at least, I find that if it keeps me honest, if I can convey what I'm doing to a broader audience, I also think, well, why do I care about these things? It's not just because I think it's cool to, you know, read Sanskrit and parse difficult texts, even though there's a pleasure in that. I'll admit that there are times where I love digging into Mimamsa because it's a challenge, you know, and I have to go learn about rituals which to me are obscure and figure out what's going on, and that's puzzling. But why did I get pulled into it? Well, it's because I think that these people that I'm reading are saying something that is still interesting and relevant today. And so it's a tension. I think it's, on the one hand, you don't want to be so broad and so focused on the current moment that you lose the way in which the past can challenge and speak to us, and can push us to be sharper. But on the other hand, if I am just constantly thinking about the sort of, I guess we would say, emic context in these categories, and just getting pulled into sort of the sort of internal small debates, small in the sense of like what does this word mean in this passage and so on, then I feel like I'm losing the big picture and why these texts were even written in the first place. So I guess I think of it as a sort of a dialectic back and forth for myself and also hopefully for people I speak with.
You know, that that response really resonates. I have all kinds of folks on the podcast, all kinds of methodologies, data projects, swabhavas, if you will, and Samatagal, honestly. I'm here to sort of be unified as a fellow academic studying what we call Hinduism and bridging it to a larger public audience who may be interested for their own edification, potential study, who knows what. And so I sort of live by sort of that straddling of these two worlds of like the nitty gritty ancient Sanskrit textual and sort of the modern Western, you know, application or relevance.
Yeah.
Sort of live there, and you know, I infer that my brain works fine. Mm-hmm. But in addition to that, I think much of the success I've enjoyed is just communicating the relevance in a grant project, in a proposal, in a, and you know, it strikes me it's a common experience for me to talk to someone about their work and understand that that person doesn't understand the relevance of their work outside of the academy. It's not that it's obsolete. Yeah. You're moved to spend, you know, 5, 7, 10 years to do a PhD, much more for the intellectual challenge of parsing out of splitting a hair. There's some, you care about it for a reason.
Yeah.
Right. And so what you say is really relevant. And I was, you know, I'm a human being, and as a human being, I'm prone to self-doubt here and there. And I was thinking to myself, you know, we've done some fairly conversational podcasts over the summer, and, you know, let's get serious now. And, you know, the minute I have this thought, you know, no one really contacts me about the podcast, which is fine. People can always contact me through my website, rajbalkarian.com, but I get this message just a couple days ago. I'm just going to read it randomly, just from a listener. I wanted to drop a note to thank you for the Hindu Studies podcast. I love how you interview people with a beginner's mind and ask the right questions, which helps the listener go deeper into the topic. Mm-hmm. Thank you for these interviews. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of the few audiences where I've got my conference colleagues listening as well as the continuing studies audience, as well as an undergrad, as well as somebody who's a heritage learner. Yeah. And that's part of the difficulty in keeping it accessible, but also being responsible and thorough. So it's interesting to hear your journey navigating that. And I think you do a good job of it. And I don't necessarily think it's everybody's Dharma.
No, it's not.
I think those who have that calling or ability, I think the academy would be well served to allow them to do that more and more.
Yeah, well, and just one last thing relating that to the book that we're talking about. I think that's the hope with this, the approach of this book, and the members of the sort of writing team here. We have members, so people who have written for this book, who are just, you know, killer Sanskritists, and who just could run circles around me at a philological level and just go really, really deep. And there are aspects of that in this book. And so I don't want my high level discussion to sort of obscure that. But at the same time, we also have people in the book who are, so one contributor who is a, I think he's working on Sanskrit, but his training is analytic philosophy, and he came to Indian philosophy later. And he is able to sort of pull out the connections that he sees between these conversations and things that he's doing now. And so what I've really tried to do in the book is have a gamut from translation and sort of exegetical papers that are sort of interpreting the text and thinking along with these thinkers, to how does this impact some current conversations in analytic philosophy. And my hope is that the reader then can work out for themselves where they want to be in that dialectic. You know, there'll be people reading the book who don't really care about the analytic philosophy, and they just want to know what, you know, how Mimamsa and Nyaya hashed this stuff out. And then there are other people for whom their question is about reasoning human reasoning and its relationship to our mental states and our use of language. And they're going to find that interesting and maybe be sort of invited into this world of Indian thought. But that's the hope. So I haven't done the complexity of the book justice necessarily, but hopefully it gives you a high level sense of what some of the debates are. And I think it's a rich book in that sense as an edited volume. It's I tried to make it a coherent whole, not just a set of disconnected papers. So
you're able to tell a story, which is wonderful quality. And with academic qualifications, there's a foregone conclusion that there's lots of slicing and dicing and nitty-gritty. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's just, I mean, people infer that from the laborious peer review process, right? Right? So in this podcast, it's safer to err on the side of accessibility. Yeah. So that's wonderful. Yeah. Thank you for making the time.
Sure, of course.
Speak with us today. We've been speaking with Malcolm Keating on a brand new 2020 Bloomsbury academic publication, Controversial Reasoning in Indian Philosophy. Until next time, stay safe, keep reading, keep listening, and keep wondering about this a mythical beast called Indian philosophy. Take care.
Great, thanks.